Sometimes the fun begins when the paved road ends. Chevy Silverado 2500 HD is made to work hard and play hard on the road or off. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com for details and experience life in HD.
WGN, a pleasant Thursday afternoon to y'all. 12:07 here. John Hansen on the Wintrust Business Lunch. And for Jisoo Kee, who will have her first Wintrust Business Lunch starting next Monday when we welcome her back from her short little vacation. Got a lot to get to today, including talks about how Illinois ranks compared to other states in terms of our credit card burden. Some of you might be surprised. I was kind of surprised where we ended up landing in terms of how we rank against the other 50 states. You might be, too. That'll be after the news at 12:30. And, of course, we've got Cranes, Chicago's Dennis Rodkin. Always a great conversation when he stops by. But Ian Scher from CNET joins us now. Ian, we've got a lot of stories to jump to. Thanks for joining us here on the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Of course. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing really well. And we got to talk. I mean, of course, Cyber Monday, now a few days old. How did it stack up against previous Cyber Mondays in terms of the deals done?
You know, it was a real record year. And I think that's interesting because I always feel like Cyber Monday is just Black Friday extended.
Right.
But it turns out that it was the biggest e-commerce sales day in U.S. history, purchasing up to $12 million a minute.
Whoa.
Which is crazy. A lot of it was due to phones. People are just much more comfortable buying stuff on phones. They spent $3.1 billion this year. And this is all, by the way, coming from Adobe. And what's really interesting, I think, is that we're starting to see that retailers are figuring out how to do this stuff. So there was a long conversation for many years about how Best Buy and Target and all of these companies and Walmart were under threat from the internet. And what they have figured out is that they've said, okay, well, our stores do have value. In particular, people like to go to the store to get their stuff, but they don't want to wait and look around and all that. So they've started this thing where you probably saw it when you were buying stuff over the weekend, unless you were boycotting, which is that you might have seen that they said, well, you could have it shipped to you, or you could pick it up in the store. And this is a trend called buy online, pick up in store, and it is huge. Adobe said that accounted for a very large chunk of retailer sales, and it shows that they're really starting to figure out how to compete against Amazon on the internet.
Yeah, and that makes sense because I've done that before too, where you know you still want to touch the thing, see the thing before you've kind of committed to it, but at the same time you want to like check it off mentally in your head that it's done, and I feel like that's kind of like the happy medium.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it'll be interesting to see how this changes because Amazon, of course, one of the funny stories that we've been seeing over the last few years is that they are opening stores, right? So this internet company is suddenly, you know, there are two grocery stores they've opened, Amazon Go stores here in San Francisco. They've opened a bookstore in Seattle. They're actually looking at opening a real grocery store in Los Angeles, like a standard grocery store. So it's going to be really interesting, not to mention they own Whole Foods. So I'm really curious to see how this is all going to change and if everyone's going to end up in this middle where they have a very strong online presence and that it's interacting with those stores in a really strong way.
CNET's got a great list of some 2019 deals still out there, even though we're well past Cyber Monday, at least a few days after it, including some stocking stuffers. It's a good list.
Yeah, and part of what we've been trying to do here is that there's this kind of trend on the internet where a lot of publications now have gotten into trying to sort through all these deals because, oh my God, there are so many of them all the time. Mm-hmm. And so what's been really interesting is that we find that a lot of our readers really want to know, okay, how can I find a good deal on X? And also teaching them the different tools that we use to find a good deal. So my favorite tool that I always use is called Camel, Camel, Camel.
Okay.
It's like the animal Camel three times. I don't know why they call it that, but what it does is that you take the Amazon link, you pop it into that website, and it'll actually tell you the price history of the thing you're looking at. So you can figure out, oh, is this a good deal? And then you can even set an alert so that you find it'll tell you when there's a good deal on it. And there are other apps out there, too. There's one called Honey, which is like the food, H-O-N-E-Y. It does it for other websites. And there's also one called Shop Savvy, which is an app you can download to your phone that you can scan barcodes with. And again, it'll tell you whether or not you're getting a good deal.
So basically, Camel, Camel, Camel tells you whether the deal holds water.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, see, and then there we go.
Yeah, that plus us is a great way to go.
All right, sounds good. Hey, really quickly before we break, I just want you to answer this question. I see Apple's next iPhone could have Qualcomm's new ultrasonic fingerprint reader. What does that mean? Because I have a fingerprint on one of my older phones. What's the difference?
Yeah, so this is something that's really interesting. Qualcomm's one of the chip companies. You probably may never have heard of them unless they were suing someone. But one of the things that they are doing is that they have they build a lot of the chips that go inside the phones, and also they build a lot of the chips that help us connect to wireless networks. Well, they've also been coming up with technology to allow you to use your fingerprint in the screen. So a lot of the phones that we had before, your fingerprint went on a special button or a home button or in the back of the phone. One of the things that people are really trying to do now is get them to work in the screen. Right now, most of that technology is not very reliable. It's also not very secure. But they say they've come up with one that's really good, and it might be something that Apple uses in the future.
It's something that I am very skeptical of, and of course, I'll get used to it immediately as soon as I get the phone and then believe in
exactly.
Everything it does. More from Ian Sher with CNET after this, including talking about all the new things that are happening with the police-public relationship, the private-public relationship having to do with Ring doorbell. Okay, the Ring doorbells are nothing new, but around the holiday time, everyone starts to think about them a little bit more as a great way to see what's happening to their missing packages on the porch. Also not new is their relationship as a company with police departments all across this country. And Ian Sher from CNET, their relationship is changing just a little bit in terms of what they have access to and what they don't have access to. But I was hoping you could rewind a little bit and kind of walk us through their private partnership with the public there or with the police departments.
Yeah, so there are 661 partnerships that Ring has struck with police departments across the United States. And they actually, to their credit, they put them all on a Google map that we have a link to on CNET that you can see whether or not your local one does. But what they're trying to do is that Ring says, you know, we want to help the police. So what can happen is that through these partnerships, police can get access to videos of crimes that may have happened. They may also help with police identifying suspects and whatnot. And in theory, this can be very good. But the concern that a lot of people have, and what we have learned over at CNET through a number of investigations we've done and breaking news on this, is that we have found that that in some cases, Ring is really opening up as much information as they can to police and creating what some advocates concern is a police surveillance state through a private company. And it's hard because one of the things that we really point out over at CNET is that Ring is not very good at telling us all about this. You know, there's a lot of this stuff that people were not aware of. They are not putting it front and center to tell you, you know, what this partnership entails. They just say they have a partnership. So there's a lot of concern about how is Ring going about this. You know, we're all putting these cameras on our homes, and they know when we come in, when we leave. They see our faces, all of this type of stuff. And there's a legitimate question to be made about what are we comfortable giving the government access to, and when should we be setting up rules around what they can see and what they can't.
So in the past, up until now, at least if I'm reading this correctly, is they wouldn't be able to know exactly what address has a camera. So it's not like they have a database of every single address. At least in theory, that's how it was supposed to work. Instead, they have access to some sort of heat map which showed the density of these cameras existing in certain blocks. Meaning if they knew a crime or something had been committed, they could kind of zoom into a 10-block radius, see the cameras that were there, and then what put a call out to people in those areas, sort of anonymous. Through the app or whatever mechanism they use to communicate with people that have it, for then people to voluntarily give up the videos. Am I understanding that correctly?
Or potentially subpoena them.
Oh,
exactly.
Wow, okay.
So that's the thing is that, you know, this is where a lot of the, well, this could happen, slippery slope debate starts,
yeah.
Right? Is that the conversation is not about should the police be stopping crime. Obviously,
right.
They should be stopping crime. But the challenge is Ring said we don't give location information to the police. But then literally this map existed until it was pointed out. And then right before we published the story on CNET, they take down the map. And so it's kind of like, okay, well, you know, you say that you're being really thoughtful about our privacy, but then you're turning around and doing things that are really questionable. And this is why I think these stories are really important. It's not about trying to stop the police from doing their job. It's about, look, we should all be on the same page. If we're going to give all this information to the police and that owning a Ring doorbell means basically the police have access to the view from my door, then be clear with me about that.
You mentioned
don't act like it's not going to be that and then turn around and actually do it.
Yeah, transparency, obviously the number one thing I imagine a consumer to company relationship should provide. But my question is with the subpoena thing, I wanted to ask about that. So what you're suggesting is if police were able to know exactly the house that had a Ring doorbell, they could then in theory go to get a court order to demand that the video be turned over. I guess what I'm asking is that hypothetical, or do you know, have you guys heard of cases where that has happened?
Well, we have seen cases where it's dealt with Amazon stuff. So Ring is owned by Amazon, and Amazon very famously, they have all these Echo devices, right, where you can scream out a name that I'm not going to use so that I don't set off everyone's devices.
Right.
So there was a death that happened, a murder, and during the collection of evidence and during the jury trial, the government actually tried to subpoena Amazon to give them recordings from these Amazon Echoes that were in that home. And they said it's possible that it could have caught the murder in process,
right?
Because, you know, every once in a while people accidentally set it off, right? And those recordings, by the way, when you talk to it, are actually sent up to Amazon's servers and are kept there for a while. So the police thought, okay, well, maybe so. But then there was a big debate about, well, wait a minute, we did not agree to giving Amazon the right to do that. A lot of people didn't even know it was keeping copies of the recordings. And by the way, also, those recordings may have other stuff in them, like private intimate moments with partners, or the list of stuff you ordered through Amazon. So there's a lot of questions about, well, again, what are we comfortable giving police unfettered access to, and how do we want to handle that? And I think that's why these stories are interesting. And by the way, if you are worried about this type of thing, a lot of government officials are starting to talk about this.
Yeah.
Go to your local government and ask them what they're doing. Go to a local city council meeting and have this brought up as a debate, because the ones who don't even know what's going on, they need to be educated about it, because it is increasingly happening all around the country.
Yeah, you guys actually have a link to a map via Google to be able to tell which municipalities are partnering with Ring, and it's fascinating. They seem to be clustered a lot of suburban areas, including right here. The city of Chicago doesn't look like it's on this list, but I'm just kind of thumbing through these. Cicero, Lincolnwood, Skokie, Morton Grove, Downers Grove, Schaumburg, Elmhurst, Villa Park, some places in Northwest Indiana. I'd suggest that if this concerns you, to find out exactly if your municipality is taking part in this and getting more involved. Okay, that's a fascinating discussion. We could talk about that all day. I want to change gears just a little bit. Let's talk about Facebook and their efforts to ramp up efforts to prevent discriminatory ad targeting. Walk us through this again.
Yeah, so a couple of years ago, the investigative organization ProPublica found out that it was easy to create an ad for housing on Facebook and to say you don't want specific people. And what I mean by that is say that you only want white people or you only want men, which is illegal, by the way.
Yes.
And so what happened was that once that came out, Facebook, it was like, oh my gosh, we had no idea. And they tried to change it. Well, a year later, ProPublica comes out with another story, and guess what? It still works. You can still discriminate against people on Facebook. So Facebook once again changed things. So now they said, okay, well, it's an issue of enforcement. So what they're going to do is that they're going to ramp up their enforcement and saying that they are actually going to create a database that people can use to search through social issue and election and all these other types of ad issues. And what they say is that they're going to create a housing selection too. So basically, not only are they saying they're going to up their enforcement, but they're trying to be more transparent by offering us access to see what these ads look like. Of course, if you're cynical about it, you could say, well, Facebook's putting it on us to find all the problems instead of them actually doing their jobs, but hey, whatever. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. I imagine that at a very minimum, the extra transparency is going to be good for us in the end, but it's really disconcerting that after 3 years, I think it's been now, they still can't figure this out. Like, it doesn't seem like it should be that hard, but here we are.
And speaking of Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg, boy, it was so many years you didn't hear much about him or see him publicly on TV or in Congress or anything along those lines, but he's making the rounds the last year or so, again defending the social network's policy on political advertisements, this time with Gayle King on CBS This Morning. Boy, he's going everywhere on the news these days.
Yeah, he's really trying to kind of stake out ground about what he wants to make sure this is Facebook's rules ahead of the election, because everyone, including me and everyone here at CNET, are just kind of thinking, oh my gosh, you know, it doesn't look like a lot has changed since 2016. Are we going to have a repeat in terms of all of this, you know, spreading of false news, all of the propaganda, you know, what all the intelligence agencies say were interference by the Russians, not to mention we've since seen from Iran and Saudi Arabia and other places, and it's really concerning. And so he wants to make clear, here are our rules, and here's how we're making sure that we're going to apply those rules so that people don't try and say, well, you know, you were used to interfere with our elections. So the latest is that he's been in this big kerfuffle with everyone over whether or not he should have any rules around whether you can lie as a politician in an ad on Facebook. And this, of course, was driven by an ad from the President of the United States, but it became a big thing because Elizabeth Warren actually put out a separate ad lying about Mark Zuckerberg and making the point that you can lie about anything. All right, I'm going to lie about everything. And public, different organizations now are actually putting out ads saying that Republicans are supporting the Green New Deal trying to make the point that if you can lie on Facebook, this can go way bad way quick.
Yeah.
And he still says, look, it's important. If you have a politician who's going for election, you should know what they're saying. And he thinks it's more important for you to know what they're saying than for him to fact check them. And he doesn't want to be the arbiter of truth, which honestly, I don't want him to be either.
Right.
But it's hard to tell how to handle this very well. And I don't know how it's going to play out, but he is very strongly making his case right now.
Another great talker there, and plenty more at CNET.com. Ian Schur, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Quick commercial break, then the news on WGN. 720 WGN, good Thursday afternoon, everyone. 12:34, and you're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch. John Hansen here for Jisuki, who will host Monday, back for her first Wintrust Business Lunch. We all look forward to that. Talking about credit card debt, there's many ways to discuss it, obviously on a very micro personal level, but it is interesting to see how Illinois or people around us stack up about the rest of the country in terms of how we are handling our credit card debt, how much of a burden it is here in Illinois. Joining us now to chat about that is Ted Rossman from creditcards.com. Ted, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Ted. So I have the rankings in front of me, and I got to say, for the most part, Illinois is kind of right in the middle.
Illinois is right in the middle. Yep, 30th out of the 50 states plus D.C. The way we calculated this ranking was to compare the average credit card debt in each state, which we got from Experian, and the median household income in each state, which we got from the census. And Illinois was pretty consistent there, too. 19th highest credit card debt, 16th highest income. It was really your relatively high income that bailed you out here.
And what do you have anything? Obviously, the income thing can be determined in a lot of different ways, depending on how many, you know, businesses are in your state, and you know the cost of living, the cost of you know, those sorts of things. In terms of credit card balances, is there any rhyme or reason to why, as we look at this burden, why 9 of the top 10 states, except for number 1, are located in the South?
A lot of that has to do with income, and that's really the way we designed this study, was to look at where it's easiest and where it's hardest to get out of credit card debt. And your income plays a huge role in that. Generally speaking, southern states have lower incomes, and there's just fewer dollars to go around. Like, case in point, the worst states on this list were New Mexico and Louisiana, and the best was Massachusetts. And they actually owe very similar amounts. The problem for people in New Mexico and Louisiana is they don't make as much. Their annual household income is $47,000, $48,000 a year, something in that range. In Massachusetts, it's $80,000. So that same level of debt is a lot easier to pay off in Massachusetts.
So I guess what you could pull from this is that, and correct me if I'm wrong, but in terms of credit card balance, the standard deviation, I guess you could say, is a much smaller amount than the median annual household income.
I think that's a good way to put it. And really our advice here is to highlight the fact that you need to pay way more than the minimum. If you only make minimum payments towards the average credit card debt, you're going to be in debt for about 2 decades. And it's going to cost you a lot of money in interest, because credit card rates are usually anywhere from about 17 to about 25%. So pay it in full if you can. If you have to carry debt, get a balance transfer card. Pay no interest for up to 21 months. That's a tremendous tailwind for helping you to get out of debt.
As we look at these numbers, obviously any individual could be on any part of this sort of spectrum. Someone might have zero credit card debt. They're doing just fine. Others way more than these averages. So why publish studies like this? Is it just to kind of raise the national consciousness or to get us talking about debt, to have that next conversation on what to do about it?
It is to spread awareness that there are ways to get out of debt. Another approach is to put 15% of your income towards your credit card debt every month. That was one of the premises that this study was built on. And if you do that in Illinois, you'll be out of debt in exactly a year, which is way, way better than if you only make minimum payments. Of course, like I said, you can do better by paying in full or getting one of those balance transfer cards, maybe taking on a side hustle, cutting expenses. It's a good time of year to think about this because the holidays are expensive, and a lot of people mark getting out of debt as one of their chief New Year's resolutions. So it's a good time to talk about this.
What does creditcards.com do?
We're basically a marketplace where people can compare different credit cards, all types, low interest, cash back, travel. Once you're out of debt, go for those rewards. That's a tremendous way to get value from your credit cards. So we let people compare cards. It's free to consumers. We also have a lot of helpful editorial content and calculators to help you manage your money.
I know a lot of people get offers in the mail, or they see plenty of commercials on their televisions or on their radios for what they should do with credit cards. Do you advise people kind of shopping around? I know when I was looking for a low APR one, once I really started digging into making a couple major purchases, I found that it was a lot more, I don't want to say complicated. There was a lot of information out there, but it was really hard to kind of boil it down into trying to pick the best one.
It's definitely a competitive market, so if you haven't compared cards in a while, it's a good time. There's lucrative sign-up bonuses, and then you really need to think about some key questions that matter to your situation. A big one is whether you carry debt or not. That's going to point you either to a low-interest card or to a rewards card. You usually have to pick one or the other. You're not going to get the best interest rate and the best rewards. But even beyond that, think about how you spend your money. There's different cards for different people that prioritize, let's say, gas and groceries versus somebody who dines out or travels a lot. It's very individual. It's not a one-size-fits-all kind of thing. And even what fit you 2 or 3 years ago might be different now.
Dennis, I got to ask you, Ted. Sorry, Dennis is my next guest, looking down at the sheet at the wrong place. Wanted to ask you, Ted, you know, there's different debates about how people should pay down their credit card debt. Some people advising going after the highest percentage rate to be able to pay it off, go in that order, and that certainly has a lot of sense to it. Some people like the snowball effect where you pay off the smallest amount of balance because it causes some positive momentum going forward, makes you feel better about it. Do you have a lane that you prefer?
Out of those two, I go with the snowball. So that's the one, as you said, where you're going to knock out the smallest amounts first. Doesn't make the most sense mathematically, but to me, it's not just the math. I think getting out of debt is really behavioral. A lot of it is about lifestyle and confidence and momentum. And I think once you pay off some of those smaller amounts, you're really going to start to get that ball rolling, and you're going to feel much more energized about paying it down. And couple this with other strategies. Get that side hustle. Sell some stuff you don't need around the house. Cut your expenses. These are all good ways to save even more and to get out of debt faster.
All right, so I'm looking through this list in terms of total credit card balance ranked by states, and I'm looking at what you guys put together for your top five and bottom five in terms of total debt burden. So who had the lowest credit card balance overall? I see Wisconsin at $6,898. Was that the lowest?
Yes, Wisconsin's the lowest in terms of amount owed. They were second lowest in our study. Massachusetts just kind of nudged them out there, mostly
because of
a higher income. But yeah, in terms of total amounts owed, Wisconsin is the lowest, and Alaska is actually the highest. I think this would surprise a lot of people. Alaska actually has a high income, too. They're ninth highest in income, and they're number one in terms of how much they owe. Number one not being a good thing in that case.
Yeah, why is that? Is there any rhyme or reason? Did you guys not have the opportunity to dive in exactly why? What are they buying up there?
The cost of living is very high there. It's such a remote place that even getting things like groceries can be very expensive. I think Alaska's a bit of an outlier. Hawaii, similarly remote geographically, that's another very expensive place. And I think that's a lot of what drove that. We talked about the southern states having high debt burdens. Interestingly, the amount that they owe there is not extravagant. Mm-hmm. It's mostly middle of the pack, but the incomes are really low in places like Louisiana, West Virginia, Arkansas, Mississippi, places like that.
The only reason I asked about Wisconsin is because they got a first-place football team, and they got everything now, apparently. Two low credit card balances as well. All right, Tim. Ted Ross. Now he called you three different names. Ted Rossman from creditcards.com. Thanks for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
All right. I'm going to get all these names straight, including the next one. Sitting by in the PPG Paints green room is Dennis Rockin from Cranes. He's going to be joining us in just a little bit. 720 WGN, John Hanson here on the Wintrust Business Lunch, and joined by Dennis Rockin of Cranes. Dennis, how are you doing today?
I'm great. How are you, John?
I don't know if you heard, I called my last guy, guest Dennis, a couple times. So I got a real
so
Dennis.
Who do I get to be?
I don't know. You get to be.
Can I choose? I'll be Bob.
You'll be Bob. All right, Bob. Well, okay, so we were kind of talking off the air a little bit. The idea, you know, the housing market's flat. It's been flat
it
for
is.
A little while.
Yeah.
You and I have kind of talked about this. Flat isn't the worst thing. Maybe not for a journalist who's got to cover this stuff all the time. But, I mean, when we ranked all the states and where these markets could be going, yeah, I know we all want it to be better, but we should at least take solace in knowing that flat is okay.
Is okay, yeah. Well, yeah, so part of what you're referring to is the story that I put out yesterday about the Realtor.com forecast for 2020 for the 100 largest metro areas in the nation. They look at number of sales and prices and how those are going to behave in each of those 100 markets. There have been years, two of them, in fact, where Chicago was number 100. We were forecast to be, and those forecasts generally played out as forecast by the end of the year. We were forecast to be the weakest market in America. So the good news is we're only at about number 86 for 2020.
Go.
They don't number them anymore. I look at the data and find the ones that have weaker forecasts than we do. And so there are about 14 cities where prices will be down more and sales will be down more than their forecast in Chicago. Oh. And those dips, those sales and price forecasts for Chicago are both down so slightly that I think what we're really looking at is the market ending 2020 where it begins.
I'm kind of surprised behind the reason of it. Maybe I shouldn't be, but in the story you talk about addressing pension funds, spending issues, these kind of large government financial issues really impacting the micro levels of housing. It just seems surprising to me that that would be of concern, but I guess it kind of just is how Illinois is portrayed as a whole, I guess.
Well,
and
part of it is there's this slogan that people use in almost any markets. Markets don't like uncertainty.
Okay.
And the uncertainty that hangs over Chicago and Chicago suburban real estate markets are, how is the pension problem going to be fixed? Is it going to be fixed with a big property tax increase?
Right.
Or in what other ways am I going to have to help to pay to fill that hole, that pension hole? And until then, it appears from the reporting I've done from the people I talk to, people are saying, well, so maybe I'm going to hold back. I don't know what my total costs will be, so I either don't buy or I buy less house than I might have. I'm willing to pay less if I might have thought my homeownership cost is $100 a month, and $10 of that has been going to taxes. Well, if it goes to 20, I can't.
Yeah.
I don't have that extra 10. So the idea is that what makes us different from other metro areas, everybody is affected by the idea that we don't know whether there's a recession coming.
Right.
It seems less likely than it did just a few months ago. We really don't know the future of the U.S. economy because there are trade wars and other things going on. But Chicago has, on top of those, this uncertainty about what's going to happen with the financial picture of Chicago and Illinois. And if you're in the suburbs, your individual suburb may also have some uncertainty for the same reason.
And I think you bring up a great point there, that if then, you know, the national indicators are great and in many may at least positive, you'd think that that would provide a solid housing market. But you're right, then you've got to start eliminating what the common denominators are across all these markets and kind of find the individual thing. So I definitely could see it, and it's certainly with the property tax thing that could do it. And again, that contributes, especially since we saw the property tax increase, what, 4 years ago, not 3 years ago, to that we're now, our growth is the smallest it's been, what, since the recession.
Yeah, our home prices are growing less than they've grown since recovery really started, and our prices are growing at about 1.6%. year over year, which is pretty small considering that there are other cities where they're up 3, 5, 6, 7%. And one of the things I always say, you know, okay, so your house, the price of your house is not going up all that fast. If you're a buyer, that's good news because it means affordability isn't running out of your out of touch. But if you're an existing homeowner or an active seller right now, what it means, if you're an existing homeowner, we should talk about them first, your household wealth, your ability to build up wealth and possibly your ability to sell the house is hampered because we have an enormous number. We have the largest number of underwater homeowners in America, and until they don't owe, or until their balance on the mortgage is healthy, being underwater means you owe more on the house than the house is worth. Until that gets healthy, they can't afford to move in many cases. So there are those, and then sellers can't get a price that makes it possible, in many cases, can't make a get a price that makes it possible for them to take the leap to the next big housing expense. Yeah. I'm moving from single to family, family to more kids, whatever it is. I can't get that out of my house.
Right.
Those are difficulties that are created. So on the one end, I'm a buyer, especially a young buyer. It's great that prices aren't going up. But for everybody else, it's not such great news.
We've got about 30 seconds to a minute left, so not too much time. But Mike Royko, his condo phase on the market, huh? That on Lakeshore Drive.
For the first time since he sold it in 1985. Yeah. So he, and it's funny because there is actually a column he wrote about it when he sold it. He was famously working class bungalow type guy. In 1981, he buys this condo on Lakeshore Drive. Really nice condo, and when selling it a few years later, he writes this column that I found that we linked to in the story where he said, well, I was trying out. I was doing an anthropological study of what it's like to be condo man, and I met Lakeshore man and high-rise man and singles bar man, but it didn't work, and I want to go back to ground-level living where I can grow my own tomatoes. So he sells the condo on Lakeshore Drive, ends up a few years later in the house in Winnetka where he eventually died. But the people who bought the condo from him, or I should say one of the two people who bought the condo from him, is selling. The other died a few years ago, but he sold to a couple. The widow is now selling it for the first time since 85.
In only a way that Mike Royko could write, too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Condo man. Yeah. And you know what's funny is when you look back at that, all those characters he was discovering must have seemed very new and unusual.
Yes.
It's the mid-80s, and he's talking about singles bar man now, you know.
That's a pretty average thing nowadays, different back then. Dennis, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, John.
And where can people find out more about this all these stories?
ChicagoBusiness.com.
Great stuff. All right. The news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom.